He figured it might be a car accident, husband and wife thing. He'd wanted to call Minty Fresh to ask him about it, but then, no. "Donnie, give me that perfume bottle behind you on the dresser." Donnie DeFazio did what he was told, handed the crystal bottle to Rivera, who slipped it in his jacket pocket. "You live here, Donnie?" "I have been. I had to move in 6 months ago to take care of my mother." Rivera nodded. Non-committal cop nod. "So your possessions? They all here in the house?" "Yes. Why? Are you going to seize my stuff when you take me in? Freeze my accounts?" Rivera shook his head at his notebook, flipped it shut, put it into his inside jacket pocket. "Nah, you're good to go, Donnie. I'm going to have a look around, though. Which is your room?" "Down the hall." Donnie moved away from the dresser. "Wait, don't I need to get a lawyer? Don't you want to see the video? She was in pain. She asked me to do it." "I know. You feel bad about it?" "Well, of course. I feel horrible about it. It's the hardest thing I've ever had to do." He started gasping again. "Well, then I'm sorry for your loss." He pointed. "Just down the hall, this way?" Donnie nodded, then grabbed his chest again, and either from relief or stress, stiffened, twitched, and slid down the front of the dresser to a splay-legged sitting position on the floor. He twitched for a few seconds, then slumped forward. "And there we go," said Rivera. He looked around, just in case Donnie's soul vessel might be sitting out like his mother's, but nothing else was glowing. He backed out of the room and headed down the hall. His phone buzzed again. There was also a text that had come in during the DeFazio deaths. "Pick the fuck up," it said. Rivera hit talk. "You said we weren't supposed to talk unless it was an emergency." "Where's your partner?" asked Minty Fresh. "He's watching my store while I'm out on a collection. I didn't hear from you on the Lily Girl, so he's filling in until I find someone." "Where are you? Not near him?" "No. In Noe Valley. Looking for a vessel. I found another death merchant. And there's more." "Yeah, we'll get to that. Y'all might want to sit down, Inspector." Nick Cavuto was reading a Raymond Chandler short story called Red Wind behind the counter when the Banshee stepped out of the stacks.
"Aye!"
Cavuto dropped the paperback as he slid off the stool into a crouch, drew a ridiculously large revolver from his shoulder holster, and leveled it at the Banshee, one motion.
"I will drop you, Raggedy," he said.
"I come to save your life, you great dolt, and you cast dispersions on me frock?"
Cavuto kept the gun trained on her and looked around it.
"Save my life, huh?
You need to get out of here before dark, lad. There's a nasty bit of business heading your way. They're not strong enough to move in the daylight yet, but they'll be here soon."
"Raven women coming to take my soul?"
Cavuto lowered the gun to his side.
"Stay there." "They can't kill a man for his soul. Don't know why. Just the way of things. Otherwise, you'd all be rotten in the fields. But they will kill you for the sport."
She moved toward him, gestured that she was moving wide of the counter, toward the front door.
"Let's go, love. Have a ride in your lovely carriage. I'll hang me head out the window when I scream."
She smiled, black lips and bluish teeth, batted her sooty eyelashes. Cavuto glanced over his shoulder and out the window. The street lights were on, and the little stripe of sky he could see was dying pink.
"There'll be no screaming."
"Aye, lad, let's go then."
She made a motion as if shooing errant chickens toward the door, the long tatters of her sleeves making trails like smoke. There was a rumble from behind the shop, and they both looked to the single window at the back of the store, high and narrow, four steel bars across it. As they watched, the window, lit yellow from the light in the alley, went black.
"Back door locked then?"
asked the Banshee. Cavuto nodded, not looking away from the window.
"Splendid! We're off, then. Come along. Go swiftly and stay long, I always say."
The rear window cracked, and the shadow of a thousand birds oozed in between the cracks and down the back wall, spreading, form and light exchanging as it moved, like oily lace woven into the shapes of flying things. The shadow slid down onto the hardwood floor, splashed in waves over the shelves as it approached them. At one narrow, central shelf where Rivera displayed recently acquired books, soul vessels, the shadow coalesced, covered the whole shelf like a shroud. The Banshee could see the five souls, glowing dull red, and one by one, as the shadow enveloped them, they started to fade.
"Mad dash, love, mad dash," she said.
"You go,"
said Cavuto. He trained the 44 Magnum on a spot at the middle of a dark shelf 15 feet away. As the last soul vessel went dark, the shadow throbbed, gained dimension, split into three distinct masses that then undulated, changed, formed into three female figures, human to a degree, shimmering with fine, blue-black feathers. Talons sprouted from the tips of their fingers, long and hooked like marlin spikes, the silver color of stars.
"Gone," said one, her voice like gravel swishing in a pan. "I hate guns."
"Well, lad, you've shat the bed now," said the Banshee.
Chapter 14. Perchance to Dream. It was a Wednesday night in San Francisco, and despite the fog having laid a soft blanket over the city and the foghorn singing its sad and low lullaby, no one slept well. Rivera. Inspector Alphonse Rivera was electrified by the shock and grief of finding Nick Cavuto dead in his bookstore. There were four units and an ambulance on the scene by the time Rivera got there. The EMTs were working on the big man on the floor, compressions on his chest, squeezing the bag to breathe for him, slamming syringes of adrenaline, and hitting him with defibrillator paddles. As soon as they got a heartbeat, they would move him, they said. There was blood, but not a tremendous amount, on Cavuto's cutaway shirt. Rivera could still smell the gunpowder in the air, as well as the more smoky aroma of burning peat. Cavuto's big stainless steel revolver lay on the floor by him. "How long?" he asked the first officer he saw with a notebook who wasn't interviewing someone. "Win" on his nameplate. Rivera going into autopilot, not allowing what was happening a few feet behind him to become part of his reality. "They've been working about 10 minutes since I've been on the scene." "Gunshot wound?" "Probably not," the cop said. He cringed. "EMT said it looked more like a stab wound. Thin blade. Ice pick, maybe."
"Witnesses?"
"People all over the street. Drinkers, diners, people walking their dogs. You know this neighborhood. No one saw shit yet. Still looking." "Shots fired," call came from the nail place next door. The officer looked at his notes. 7:02. First unit on the scene a minute later. Found him like this. Rivera checked his watch. 7:15. Rivera looked around. The shelf where he had displayed the soul vessels was sprayed with a fine, oily fuzz, like black down, and even as Rivera watched, it was evaporating into vapor. He'd seen it before, a year ago. On the bricks in the alley where he pumped 9 9-millimeter rounds into one of the Morrigan to rescue Charlie Asher.
"We're moving him,"
barked one of the EMTs.
"He's back?"
Rivera asked. The EMT whipped his head.
"No, I'm calling an audible. We can get him to St. Francis in 5. He needs a surgeon. Wound may have hit the heart."
The other EMTs had already lifted Cavuto onto a gurney. Uniformed cops were clearing the way to the ambulance.
"We'll work on him until we can't," said the EMT over his shoulder as he went out the door. "Tell them to check for venom," Rivera said.
The EMT raised his eyebrows.
"Just do it."
The EMT nodded and was out the door.
"People next door said they heard 6 shots. Quick," said Officer Wynn. "Very, very loud."
Rivera walked to the display shelf. The books, the 5 soul vessel books, were still there, lying on the floor, but they no longer glowed. 2 rounds had hit the books on the top shelf, tearing cantaloupe-sized holes through the books, leaving shredded paper in the cavity like it had been nested by hamsters. He looked to the back of the store. 2 more portals of shredded paper where the rounds had hit the books on the back wall. Wynn moved to his side as the last of the black feathers vaporized.
"What the fuck is that stuff? It was all over the place when I got here."
"No idea," said Rivera. Then, still on emotional autopilot, crime scene robot on the scene, he said,
"All the shots were Cavuto's."
He pointed to the four impact points with his pen. He saw Wynne's eyes go wide at the craters in the books before him. "He used SWAT loads," Rivera explained. Caruto loaded the .44 with very high-speed, pre-frangelized bullets, a copper jacket filled with lead beads encased in resin, half the weight of a normal .44 round, thus the high speed. But when they hit, they expanded explosively, doing enormous damage to flesh, or in this case, paper, used by law enforcement because they didn't ricochet and would not go through walls or car doors to hurt innocents. Essentially, they blew up on the first thing they hit. And Cavuto had hit what he was aiming at, thus the spray of hellish down. Wynne ran his own pen around the edge of one of the craters in the books, careful not to actually touch it. "So these rounds went through someone before they hit here?" "Something," Rivera said. "If it had been someone, there'd be a pile of ground meat here to identify and clean up."
"Fuck," said Wynne.
"Yeah," said Rivera. "I'm headed to St. Francis. Tell the watch commander, would you?" Rivera did not hurry, because he knew there was no reason to hurry. They wouldn't be bringing Nick Cavuto back to the land of the living. They continued to work on the big cop for 45 minutes, after Rivera arrived at the hospital without getting so much as a blip of a heartbeat. They pronounced him dead a little after 8 p.m. A captain from Personal Crimes debriefed Rivera at the hospital. After which, two commanders took turns telling him to go home and stay away from the case, which he finally did when they threatened to suspend him if he didn't. At home, he texted Minty Fresh about Cavuto's death, then ate something, but he didn't remember what, turned on the TV and sat in front of it, but he couldn't have said what was on, then went to bed and lay there, staring at the ceiling, his Glock 40 cal in his hand, until 6 a.m., when he finally fell into a fitful, jerky sleep, with dreams full of the sound of frantic birds scratching at windows. Minty Fresh. Minty Fresh lay awake mentally arranging jazz albums by artist and recording date, cross-referencing who played what on which record, listening in his mind's ear to the signature riff of each artist as he came to mind. It was a rich, complex, demanding exercise, but it kept him from thinking about the dead cop, the dark rising, and the task he would have to perform tomorrow. It kept him from reaching that place that he hit so often in his life, the mind-bending, sob-inducing limit, where he said to himself, "I just cannot endure any more motherfucking death. No more." Order. Put everything in order. Serve order. That was the why and what of it. Order. In his head, he flipped albums, looked at liner notes, grainy photographs taken in smoky clubs, listened to notes played by men long dead, and he put them in order. Round midnight, he drifted off. Mike Sullivan. Mike couldn't remember being this excited to go to sleep since Christmas Eve when he was a kid. The excitement. The anticipation, the replaying over and over of how it would be, knowing that no matter how you imagined it, you'd be surprised. This was just like that, but instead of waking up to find that Santa had brought him a new bike or a fire truck with an extending ladder, he loved that fire truck, he was going to get up in the morning and throw himself off a bridge and die. He knew he should feel sad about it. In fact, he even felt a little guilty for not feeling sad. But he didn't feel sad. He'd miss his apartment and some of his friends, but not that much, really. Not compared to what it might be like. And there was the Christmas morning part. He was going to die, but he was not going to end. There was something else out there, more exciting and unknown than even a bike under the Christmas tree. And somehow there was an inevitability to all of it. He didn't feel like this was a choice he was making, but more like a choice that had been made long ago, and he was just fulfilling it. Like riding on a train, waiting for your station. You don't decide at each station to stay or go. You get to your station and you get off. He was coming to his station. He ran the Sanskrit chant through his head, which wasn't hard. It was only a few words. Audrey had written them out phonetically for him, and since he'd first learned them and repeated them, they had rung in his head constantly. With a chant sounding in the background, he checked and rechecked the arrangements he'd made for Charlie Asher to take over his life, going so far as to label certain shirts that he thought looked good on him, certain background details he shared with the guys at work, listing each of their social network profiles so if Charlie ever ran into them, he might recognize them from their pictures. He liked that someone was getting his stuff, even his body, as if he was giving someone who was really hungry half of his sandwich, after deciding he might have to throw it away. It was all so exciting. Charlie had called him, and in his strange, scratchy little voice, thanked him for what he was going to lose. "Ha! Lose? You're welcome, but no, not lose," he said. "A gift," he said, "and thank you." Concepcion. 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 Concepcion! My Conchita! My love! He had never felt like this, and it was glorious. He ached for her. His soul sang electric with the thought of her, and tomorrow he would be with her. He didn't remember falling asleep, and he didn't care that he did, because in the morning he would get up, go to the bridge, then jump off and die. Lily. Lily lived in the Sunset District, where San Francisco was open to the sea, so even when the rest of the city was warm and sunny, the fog rolled in over Ocean Beach and the Great Highway to settle between the rows of post-war tract homes. Lily liked the fog and didn't even mind the cold wind. She reckoned that Ocean Beach, the dunes there, and the sunset were the closest San Francisco was going to come to the foreboding, windswept moors of England, where she had aspired to suffer romance and heartache when she was a kid. The foghorn, however, rather than a lonesome lament that conjured images of Heathcliff's dark figure waiting with clenched jaw on the moor for her to bring light and warmth into his life, sounded like a distressed moose tied up in her neighbor's garage, having his nutsack singed with jumper cables at a precise interval calculated to keep her from falling asleep, which, in turn, made her think of what complete douchebags people could be when all you wanted to do was borrow a defibrillator. Then she was awake and angry. "Look, I just need it for a few hours," she told the ambulance guy. "They have to stay with the ambulance, miss," the stupid guy had said. "We can't lend them out." "Look, nurse, I'm trying to save lives over here. I swear, I'll have it back to you in like 3-4 hours max." "Still can't do it. Even if we could, these aren't the consumer models like they hang on the wall at the airport. We're trained to use these." "Quoi?" she had said in perfect fucking French. "They just hung defibrillators on the wall at the airport? Those things cost like $5,000, which she hadn't known when she said she'd take care of getting one. And they just hang them there for anyone to use? She needed to travel more. A quick search on her phone revealed that they hung them on the wall at City Hall, as well as at the airport, and she was only a few blocks from there. But she hadn't really been sure she wanted to try to get on the bus or the BART while making off with a stolen defibrillator. So she had called her friend Abby, who had a car. "Abs, we're getting the band back together," Lily said. "I have to work at 4, Abby said. "It's an emergency, like an hour max. Can you pick me up at the corner of Polk and Pine?" "Okay, but I'm going to be dressed for work." 20 minutes later, Abby showed up in her beater Prius and Lily jumped in. "What are you wearing?" was the first thing Lily said. "For work," Abby said. She was wearing a khaki skirt, black tights, a crisp white blouse, and flats. If not for her hair, which was still short and dyed a deep maroon, Lily wouldn't have recognized her. "Retail?" Lily asked. Abby nodded. "I'm a failure. What are you wearing?" Lily was in black jeans, ankle boots, and a red SF Fire Department t-shirt, which she had thought might help her with the ambulance guys. "Me too," she said. The two failed goth girls shared a high five and hugged it out for their shame. Then Lily said, "Head up Van Ness and pull in front of City Hall." "I can't park there. There's a bus stop." "You're not parking. It's an emergency." Lily outlined the plan on the way. "I need to steal a defibrillator." "Okay, I'll drive," said Abby. "No, you have to come in with me." "Why? They aren't heavy. Are they heavy?" "No, but I haven't done this before." Abby pulled the Prius up onto the sidewalk in front of City Hall, and they both jumped out.
"My friend is having a heart attack! My friend is having a heart attack!" Lily chanted as she led Abby up the steps and continued chanting it as they ran up the hall. "My friend is having a heart attack! Make way!"
When people looked, Abby said, "Hey, fuck off! I'm having a heart attack!" Finally, they spotted a bright red plastic box inside a larger, clear plastic box near a fire extinguisher.
"You want this too?"
Abby said, her hand on the fire extinguisher handle.
"No, just this."
Lily pulled open the plastic box and pulled out the defibrillator, which was about the size of a small laptop computer. There was a readout and a single yellow button. Then the box started talking.
"Place pads on patient's chest," said the box.
Unfortunately, Lily and Abby had attracted enough attention on their way to the defibrillator that a group of about a dozen people had gathered around them to either help the skinny girl or watch her twitch.
"Place pads on patient's chest," said the box.
Lily popped open a little door on the defibrillator, and two vinyl pads, about the size of coasters, stuck together, fell out, trailing wires behind them.
"What do we do?"
Abby said.
"Place pads on patient's chest," said the box.
Lily held the box between her legs, separated the two pads, then tore open Abby's blouse and slammed the pads on her boobs.
"You bitch!" said Abby.
She grabbed the front of Lily's shirt and made to tear it open, but instead just stretched it out and spun Lily halfway round.
"Heart rhythm normal. Do not shock," said the box.
"What's going on here?"
came a voice from down the hall. It was a heavy-set, cop-like guy, in that he had a gun and a uniform, but he didn't look like he ever had to do any difficult cop stuff. Abby took off running the way they had come. Lily grabbed the defibrillator just as it was about to be yanked out of her hand and followed.
"Heart attack! Heart attack!" Abby yelled ahead. "Out of the way! I'm having a fucking heart attack!"
"She is!" said Lily, holding up the defibrillator as she ran.
"Slow down, Abs! You're pulling out the wires!"
Abby jumped into the Prius. Lily bundled the defibrillator into her friend's lap, then jumped in the Prius's back door behind her.
"Go! Go! Go!"
And with all the roaring fury of a golf cart escaping the back nine, they sped into the traffic on Van Ness and were immediately stuck behind a bus, which, it turned out, didn't matter, because no one was chasing them.
"Do not shock. Heart rhythm normal," the box said.
"You got electro-stick'em on my best bra," Abby said. "I have to change before work now."
"They look good on you, though, like a sexy torture robot."
"Yeah?"
Abby was trying to look at her chest while driving.
"See if there's extras in the little box."
So that had happened, and Lily had called M and told his voicemail, "No problem on the defibrillator, I'll have it for you." But then doubt started rising as evening came on, and by midnight she really, really wanted to be asleep, not thinking about killing a guy, but the stupid foghorn. What ships didn't have radar and stuff? They still had to use 19th century technology to keep from crashing into rocks? She went to her bedroom window, threw up the sash, and stuck her head out as the foghorn sounded.
"Really?"
she shouted. Again the horn.
"Seriously? How about you be quiet?" said Mr. Lee,
the old Chinese guy who lived in the apartment below her and was hanging out the window smoking.
"Sorry,"
she said, and slunk back to bed. Audrey and Charlie. Since meeting with Mike, Audrey had spent 3 days fasting, chanting, and meditating, preparing herself to perform the ritual of Cho, trying to achieve the mental state necessary without, of course, thinking about achieving the mental state necessary, which is sort of the tricky part of Buddhism. Late Wednesday night found her sitting in the lotus position on a wide padded stool at the end of the bed while Charlie paced frantically around her, nervous about his big moment. She had not slept and would not sleep, having achieved the state of waking trance that she would need to maintain through the ritual. But Charlie's toenails, sticking on the carpet, threatened to pull her out of her trance. Calmly, evenly, quietly, she said, "Charlie, please." "I can't sleep. I've tried. All the things that could go wrong. What if it doesn't work and Sophie never has her daddy? You could have done all this for nothing. Mike might back out, and who could blame him? I'm sure there's a way I could screw this up. And you know, if there's a way to, I will. And not only that, please, she said. Not a note of alarm or anger. Every breath with purpose. I just can't sleep. There's the... And he was off again. Snick, snick, snick. Audrey, her face a model of the beautiful and compassionate Buddha, stood on the cushioned stool ever so slowly, Venus rising from the sea on the half-shell, and let her silk saffron robe slip off her until she stood there naked. Hey, Charlie said. Wow, what are you... Charlie, all of his vital energies and most of his fluids having been inspired to swiftly migrate to his enormous dong, was spun around as the member unfurled from his waist until it achieved its full appreciation. Then he plopped over on his side, unconscious, on the rug, where he remained, snoring, until dawn. Audrey slowly lowered herself back into the lotus position and continued her meditation through the night. The Morrigan. They had once been death goddesses of the Celts, the Three, and had reigned over the battlefields of the North for 1,000 years, plucking souls from the dead and dying, and driving warriors on with fury and terror, switching from their raven and crow forms to the silky, razor-clawed harpy women as whim and wind suited them. Now they were patchwork shadows, licking their wounds in a closed train tunnel under Fort Mason, Great Meadow, unable even to hold three-dimensional form. Distinguishable from the oil stains left by the tractors and other heavy equipment stored in the tunnel, only in that they were moving.
Did guns get worse?
Asked Nemaine, the venomous one, trying to hold on her left arm, which was attached by only a thread of pitch.
I was shot when I was above before, and I don't remember it being this bad.
She tried to will herself to hold form, but melted back a flat shadow. She looked to the man in yellow, who sat in the seat of the skip loader, leaning on one elbow.
And it wasn't the same one who shot you before?
Asked the yellow fellow.
Different. Bigger. Bigger gun. But I stung him in the heart before he shot my arm. We're going to need more souls to heal, said Macha,
who had reverted to the shadow of her bird form, a hooded crow. The cold, fog-diffused moonlight in the tunnel shone through ragged holes in her wings and breasts.
The five that were in the bookstore were barely enough for us to take form. Now! I want to take the head of the banshee, said Babd,
the third of the sisters, who leaned on the wheel of a skip loader for balance, her left leg gone from the shin down. She had wielded the terrifying screech that drove warriors to suicidal frenzy on the battlefield. So the more gentle screamer, the banshee, had always been especially annoying to her.
But I can't do it with only one leg. We need souls.
Ladies, ladies, relax. I will bring you what you need, he said.
And he would. He hadn't anticipated the setback of a heavily armed policeman who had been forewarned by a banshee when he sent them into the soul seller's store. They hadn't been strong enough for that. And now they weren't even strong enough to go above and hold a useful form, or, if necessary, face the Luminatus and her hellhounds. He wasn't exactly sure he wanted them to be. They had torn his predecessor, Orcus, to pieces. It was a dilemma he needed to ponder. He would bring them what they needed to heal, but only what they needed.
For now y'all can lick your wounds in the trunk of the Buick. I'll be back in a butterfly wink.
He limped off down the tunnel, alongside the heavy equipment, limp not because he was injured, but as a matter of style. When he was gone, Bab said,
How long is that? Is that more than a week? He's being colorful, said Nemaine. He's very colorful. If I want any color out of him, I'll open one of his veins, said Macha. Ooh, I like that. Said Babd. I'm going to say that to the banshee. Not the same, said Macha, shaking her shadowy head. Yeah, said Nemaine. No blood. Butterflies, said Babd. Yuck!
She shuddered so that even in her shadow form, her feathers bristled with revulsion. Chapter 15. Thursday at the Bridge. Thursday was similar to any other workday for Mike Sullivan, in that he got up, got dressed, and drove to the bridge. But this Thursday was a little different, in that he wouldn't be driving back. He was awakened by the knock on his door, and when he opened it, a thin woman with severe blonde hair dropped a gear bag at his feet. "What are you, about 40 long?" she said instead of hello. "Huh?" said Mike.
"Jacket size."
"Yeah, a 40.
"Yeah, me too," she said.
38, actually, but I like shoulder pads. I have to have the waist taken in a little, too.
"Okay," said Mike.
"I'm Jane. I'm going to be your new sister."
Mike shook her hand.
"No, gotta go. I'm on the catch team. There's motocross leathers in there. Not really leather, though some kind of bulletproof fabric. They were my brother's. Should fit you. If they're snug, that's good. They'll hold your bones in place."
Mike was suddenly wide awake. It was the "hold your bones in place" line that did the trick.
"There's plates over the spine, elbows, forearms, knees. All should fit under your coveralls without showing. I also threw in a kayaker's helmet."
"No," said Mike. "Look, I'm just trying to keep you from getting too mashed up. I'm not wearing a helmet."
"You wear a hard hat on the bridge, don't you?"
"Yeah, but fine, wear that."
"I will."
"Okay, there's also a 5-pound paper bag of sand in the satchel. You want to throw that in right before you jump. I mean, right before you jump. You're basically going to jump into the hole that the bag makes in the surface of the water."
"How do I get a 5-pound bag out onto the bridge unnoticed?"
"Do you ever bring your lunch?"
"Well, yeah, but you aren't going to need your lunch today. Take the sand instead. If everything goes right, you'll just knock yourself out and drown."
"You're kind of being mean to me, considering..." He realized then that she hadn't looked him in the eye once since she'd shown up. Now she did.
"I'm just trying to get through this, okay, Mike? I can't get my head around what you're doing for us, and it's easier if I think of you as some random insane guy."
"Sure, I get that. I'm sometimes overly stern with the mentally ill. I'll work on that."
Thanks.
She held her arms out stiffly, offering a hug above the gear bag at their feet. Mike leaned over and shared an awkward, only collarbones touching, back patting hug with her.
"Okay, good talk," Jane said, pushing away.
"You have the number?"
"Yes," Mike said. "So unless something different happens with the weather, I'll see you at 9.
9, Mike said.
"Thanks," she said.
"Really."
Then she quick-stepped away down the hallway, like she was trying to get through a haunted graveyard as fast as possible without actually running. They had rented a 24-foot Boston Whaler from the marina by the ballpark. Rivera was to have been their pilot, but they'd agreed to call him off when they got news of Cavuto's murder. Jane stood at the center console, steering. Minty Fresh stood to her side, holding the stainless rail on the console, towering over her. On the deck behind Jane, Audrey sat in the lotus position, apparently in some kind of trance, although she could move and react when they needed her to. Her head bobbed as the boat bounced over a light chop in the bay. Charlie, in his wizard robe and a dog's life jacket that had come with the boat, was at the stern, wedged between the bait box and a large waterproof suitcase that Minty Fresh had brought on board.
"So, a green wetsuit?" said Jane.
"Bold choice."
"I wanted it in sea foam," said the mint one, who was already wearing his fins. "But the guy who was making it could only get neoprene and forest green."
"Very froggy," said Charlie, shouting to be heard over the big twin mercury outboards.
"You need to consider your glass house," said Minty.
"But hey, webbed feet,"
Charlie said, wiggling his duck feet before him.
"Nice, right?"
Jane glanced back.
"I can't even look at you like that. It's just like Mom used to say, you're a freak of nature."
"Mom said that?"
Charlie thought he was pouting. But since he had no lower lip to protrude, it looked more like his jaw was flapping in the breeze.
"Well, she did one time. She was repeating what I had just said when she asked me to drive you to school one day. Still."
"Not for much longer,"
said Minty Fresh, letting them both off the hook of family history.
"Shh," shushed Jane. "We're harshing Audrey's chi or something."
Jane throttled down the outboards a little as they rounded Alcatraz, and the current coming in the Golden Gate kicked the waves up.
Where'd you learn to drive a boat? Minty Fresh asked.
Our dad used to take us fishing, shouted Charlie. Jane always got to drive the boat.
Shh, shushed Audrey, who evidently was not as deep in trance as they thought.
Sorry,
said Charlie.
Uh-oh, said Jane as she steered toward the north tower of the bridge.
That's not good.
A finger of fog was streaming in through the Golden Gate. From their position, it appeared to be above the water, but below the deck of the bridge. Minty Fresh lifted his sunglasses to get a better look.
You can see the steer, right?
So far, said Jane, but I don't know if we'll be able to see the bottom of the bridge from under it. It might be a whiteout by the time we get there.
She checked her watch. 5 minutes later, when they were half a mile out, the fingerling of fog had taken on the aspect of a snowy knife blade, inserting itself between the bridge towers and the water just below the roadway.
We won't be able to see the bottom of the bridge, said Jane, digging in her rain jacket pocket for her phone. I'm calling it off.
Lily was supposed to be at work at 9, and she had actually been headed that way. But after dropping off the defibrillator at Charlie's store for his sister and learning that the big gay cop Cavuto had been killed, she started to shake. And as her bus approached her stop near the crisis center offices, she realized she just couldn't do it. She got off the bus and flagged down a taxi.
Take me to the Golden Gate Bridge, she said.
You want me to take you to the visitor center or to the bridge? Because if I take you to the bridge, I'm going to have to go to Marin to turn around and pay the toll to come back, and it's going to cost you.
Sure, the visitor center, she said, not really thinking it through.
She got out of the cab at the visitor center and paid, then started running up the trail for the bridge. She hadn't even gotten to the toll booths before she was out of breath and had to slow to a walk. She checked the time on her phone, 8:55, 5 minutes. She started to jog in the wobbly, ankle-breaking way that drunk girls do, although she wasn't drunk, just really out of shape. He was going to jump off from the steel structure under the road, about 200 feet south of the North Tower. She looked up. She wasn't even to the South Tower. She'd never make it. And if she did, what was she going to do? You couldn't even get to where he was going to be from the walkway. At least, she didn't know how to get there. But there was fog coming in under the bridge, like a plank or something. He wouldn't jump in the fog. That was one of the plans. She was sure of it. She scrolled up his number and pressed dial. This was her thing. This was what she did. This was what made her special. She would get the bridge painter off the bridge.
Hi, Lily, Mike said.
Mike, you can't do this. Not today.
I have to, Lily. But I wouldn't be here if not for you.
She made an exasperated growling noise.
Are you okay? Mike asked. You sound like you're choking. Are you crying?
No, I'm running.
She was crying.
I'm right above you on the walkway.
She was kind of above him, and she was on the walkway. She just wasn't right above him on the walkway, by about a quarter of a mile.
That's very sweet of you, Mike said. But really, I'll be fine. I don't know. I feel like I'm done here.
You're totally not done. You paint the bridge. I'm looking at it. I can see a spot you missed right here. There's rust.
This is what's supposed to be, Lily. She needs me. They need me.
She held the phone to her chest until the urge to scream that he was a fucking lunatic passed. Then, very calmly, she said,
Just come up, Mike. This is a bad idea. There's fog. You can go back down if your mind is set on it. But for now, please, just come up here. Hang out with me for a little bit. I'm waiting.
Are you using the promise of sex thing on me, Lily?
No, that's not what this is. That's a different thing completely. This is...
Well, that would be lovely, and under other circumstances, I'd jump at the opportunity.
Really?
He did not just say that. Did he really just say that?
I mean, I'm flattered, but Concepcion is waiting for me, and she has my heart.
Mike, did you just call that ghost your boo?
Goodbye, Lily. Thank you. I have to go. I have another call.
Her phone beeped as he disconnected. She stopped walking and just looked at it.
Are you fucking kidding me? She screeched. A father who was walking his two elementary school kids across the bridge took their heads and steered them away from the foul-mouthed girl with too much eye makeup. He glared over his shoulder at her.
Oh, lick my love luge, Dockers! I'm trying to save a fucking life here!
She couldn't see the screen of her phone through the blur of her tears. She wiped her eyes on her sleeve and looked again. 9 o'clock. Hi, Jane, Mike said into the phone. He stood on a beam under the roadway facing the city, one arm wrapped around a crossbeam. He'd already slipped out of his safety harness, leaving the lines attached to the bridge. At his feet, the bag of sand. The chant Audrey had taught him was repeating in his mind, over and over and over, as constant as the ocean.
Mike, it's not a go, said Jane. We can't even see you.
Mike looked down on the strip of fog that was streaming, not more than 20 feet below him. Incredibly dense, but wispy and soft-looking on top. Looking out, the bay was clear all the way to Berkeley, the fog only coming in from the ocean side, the strip of vapor like the fog bank testing the temperature of the bay before coming through the gate. He'd seen it before. He'd seen it all.
It's clear all around you, though, right? Mike said.
Yes, but not above us. It's not safe.
Concepcion materialized before him, about 10 feet away, smiling, her arms out. Mike laughed.
Goodbye, Jane. Take care of my body.
Eyes forward, knees a little bent, hands in a fist, he thought. He crouched, put his phone on the beam, then stood and faced Concepcion, holding the bag of sand before him.
Come to me, she said. Come to me, my sweet Nicolasha.
The Sanskrit chant circling in his head, Mike dropped the bag of sand and stepped out into space. The man in yellow could just hear them saying, after the Morrigan killed the cop and took the soul vessels from the bookstore, completely wasting them, he could just hear them saying, they're creatures of darkness. It's not like they're just going to waltz right in broad daylight and take the souls. Everybody likes a surprise, he thought. So, just a little after 9 in the morning, when a pasty guy in big glasses flipped the open sign on the front door at Fresh Music, the man in yellow waltzed right in broad daylight, to take the souls. It was a nice store, stained glass in the front windows, true to the Edwardian architecture of the building. Poster-sized black-and-white photos of jazz, soul, and rock greats. Iconic album covers and frames over the racks of used vinyl. Bitches Brew, Lush Life, Sticky Fingers, Abbey Road, Born to Run. The yellow fellow strolled by the racks, flipping an album here, there, looking for that beautiful red glow that the ladies love so. The store was laid out in a barbell shape. He paced the whole front, then paused at the counter before going to the back. The guy behind the counter was about 30, wearing a too small plaid cotton short sleeve, the bottom buttons unbuttoned, the shirt flaring over too tight, too short, gold polyester dress slacks, his hair a tangled mushroom shape, his beard more the function of not shaving than grooming. That shit was growing down his neck. The yellow fellow looked over the counter at the guy's shoes, like something out of a Dorothea Lange Depression work camp photo, toes all bent up and nasty.
Can I help you?
Said Neckbeard, a little indignant, the yellow fellow in his personal space.
What's your name?
Evan, said Evan.
Evan, this everything?
Yellow stirred the air with a long finger to include the whole store.
This your whole inventory?
There are a few things in the back room. Mostly duplicates, some estate stuff I'm supposed to unpack and file. Nothing good.
Uh-huh. Said
Yellow, noticing the locked glass case on the wall behind the counter was conspicuously half-empty.
What you got in there?
Evan looked over his shoulder, dismissively, shrugged. Some rare pressings, first editions. Usually these three shelves on the right are what the owner calls his special collection. Just crap, mixed-up genres, vinyl, 78s, 45s like a Fleetwood Mac CD, a beat-up wax Edison cylinder, worthless, not anything anybody'd want. No need to lock them up.
But he do. He locked them up. Keep watch on them like they solid gold, right?
Yeah, said Evan, just weary of it all. I don't understand it. Unless he's keeping them ironically because they are worthless, so he's kind of making a statement by pretending they have value.
So where, ironically, do you think he put them?
Shrug. Who cares? Yellow's hand shot out and struck Evan's throat like a viper, catching his windpipe between his thumb and fingers, pinching it. Evan made a cat-yacking up-a-hairball noise, but could not move.
I'm gonna tell you something ain't nobody else in the world can tell you. You got no soul, and I'm gonna tell your future, too. You ain't never gonna get a soul. You keep making people shit small.
Evan's eyes started to roll back in his head, and the big man shook him like dust mop until he came back to the room.
You ain't shit, Evan, and you ain't never gonna be shit until you show some passion for something. Y'all gotta love something. Y'all gotta hate something. Y'all gotta want something.
Pissing on other people's passion, 'cause you trying to be cool, just make you a coward.
A little bitch. Shake, rattle, roll. You don't love nothing, Evan. You're no use to me. You're no use to anyone. In fact, I'ma choke you out. Say goodbye to the world, Evan.
Wait!
Evan gasped.
Wait what? Ain't no thing. I'ma choke you out, ironically, Evan, so you be too cool for school. Cool as a motherfucking corpse, Evan.
He let a little air through.
I love something! I do love something!
You do?
My cat, Cisco!
Cisco? After the outlaw?
After the networking company.
Yeah, I'm sure enough gonna choke this motherfucker out,
Yellow said to the ceiling, just an amen short of preaching.
There won't be anyone to take care of him. The people in my building will take him to the shelter and they'll put him down.
Yellow loosened his grip.
Evan, did you just say something that wasn't about you?
Evan nodded as best he could.
Where is the shit was in that case?
With Fresh. It was gone this morning when I got here.
Tell you what, Evan, I'm gonna give you a gift of passion. You got a passion for finding the shit was in that case.
Yellow let him go. Evan fell back against the glass case, gasping. The man in yellow reached in his vest, pulled out a business card, and threw it on the counter.
That shit turn up, you call that number.
Evan nodded.
And that's all you know about this encounter, Evan. You got a passion for finding that shit and calling that number. You didn't see nobody. You didn't hear nobody. You don't even know how you got that card.
Evan nodded.
And shave your motherfucking neck.
Yellow pulled a silk handkerchief from his breast pocket and wiped his choking hand as he left the shop.
That shit is nasty.
The bell over the door rang and Evan looked up, surprised that no one was there. No one had been in all morning. Just as well. He could feel a sore throat coming on.
It's done, Audrey said. She opened her eyes and looked around.
What's done? Said Jane. She looked up from her phone just in time to see a dark shape plummeting out of the fog bank above them. Two things hit the water with explosive impact, only about 15 feet from the boat.
Pow! Pow!
A waterspout shot up and dispersed over and around them.
Holy fuck!
Jane said, staring at the water.
Audrey, can you hand me that?
Minty Fresh said, pointing to the big gray suitcase at the stern. His diving mask was on his head. He hit a button on his watch.
Holy fuck!
Jane said. Audrey stood, grabbed the handle, and swung it over to the big man, who stepped past the console and set it in the bow.
What's in there? Audrey asked.
Soul vessels, said the mint one. After Cavuto, I wanted them with me.
Holy fuck!
Jane said, still staring at the settling spot where Mike had hit the water.
Jane!
Said Minty Fresh. She shook off the amazement and looked at him.
We need to get into the water.
Jane shook her head.
Too much current. Someone has to drive the boat.
She wore a wetsuit under a yellow Gore-Tex rain jacket, which she had refused to take off because she wasn't happy about her butt. Minty looked to Audrey, who shook her head.
Fine. Fold down that swim platform, Audrey,
said Minty. He moved to the rear of the console, his fins now in the space where Audrey had been sitting, sat on the gunwale, then pulled down his mask, put his snorkel in, and flipped over backward into the water. He took one breath on the surface and dove, his fins standing straight up out of the water like the flukes of a sounding whale. Sirens began to sound on the bridge.
There's enough foam in those motorcycle leathers to bring him to the surface, Jane said. Isn't there?
Audrey shrugged. Who knows? Jane maneuvered the boat to keep it near the point of impact. Without a word, Audrey reached over the stern of the boat and folded down an aluminum antique swimming platform that formed a little dock at water level next to the big mercury outboards. Jane pulled a backpack with the defibrillator in it out from under the console and handed it back to Audrey. They watched the water fizz where Mike had gone in, looking for any sign of movement. A shadow rose in the deep green water, and heads broke the surface. A geyser of seawater sprayed into the air as Minty Fresh cleared his snorkel. He looked around, located the boat, then hooked Mike under the chin in the crook of his arm and started kicking for the boat.
Backboard, said Audrey.
She was still in her nun robes, yellow and maroon silk, now beginning to whip in the cold wind. There was an orange plastic backboard lashed to the rail on the console. Jane slipped the knot and handed one end of the board back to Audrey, who caught it by one of the many handles. The two of them lowered it over the side and waited. Minty Fresh swam Mike's limp body up to the backboard, then pushed him onto it as Jane and Audrey held it steady. The big man cinched a nylon strap around Mike's chest, then another around his feet, then kicked back to the swim platform, which he launched himself up and around into a sitting position. He allowed himself one breath, pulled his fins off, and threw them into the boat, then was on his feet, reaching over the side to grab the backboard.
Just pull his head up. We'll slide him up out of the water, said Audrey.
They did, sliding the board up, then turning it so it would fit in the open part of the boat behind the console. Audrey and Minty Fresh immediately fell to their knees over Mike.
Jane! Called the Mint One, tossing his head to point.
The boat, in neutral, had drifted and was dangerously close to the South Tower Pier, which loomed above them.
Holy fuck!
Jane said. She dove for the console, threw the throttle forward, and powered away from the massive concrete monolith.
Easy, said Minty.
Audrey flipped the strap off the backboard, unzipped the front of Mike's coveralls, then his leathers. Mercifully, he wasn't wearing anything under the leathers. The defibrillator started making a high-pitched whine as the capacitor charged.
Place pads on patient's chest, said the defibrillator. Charging!
Minty Fresh handed Audrey the pads, which she separated and stuck on Mike's chest.
Please stand clear. Do not touch patient.
Audrey pulled back her hands. The defibrillator fired. Mike's body convulsed, relaxed. Then he started coughing.
What? What? Said Jane. He's back, Minty said.
Audrey fell forward across the body and let loose a soul-shaking sob. Audrey felt a hand on her head, pushed back, looked at the guy on the backboard.
Charlie?
Hey, baby, he said. She lost herself again, sobbing into his chest.
Ouch, 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 said Charlie. I can't move my other arm.
Your shoulder is dislocated, said Minty Fresh. Just try to lie still.
He nodded toward Audrey.
She says the ritual will heal a lot of the damage. Don't ask me how. We'll hand you over to the Coast Guard rescue boat like we planned. They'll take you to the hospital.
Coast Guard closing, Jane said. She turned at the console and looked down on Charlie.
Hey, little brother. Welcome back. You're all grown up.
Hey, Jane.
He grinned at her, then looked up, trying to see past his feet.
What about him?
In the stern of the boat was Charlie's former crocodile guy body, his wizard robe saturated with seawater, his little duck feet twitching as if he was being electrocuted.
Chapter 16, A Brand New Day. Charlie was actually grateful that they made him stay in the hospital over the weekend while doctors evaluated his injuries, mostly, it seemed, because they wouldn't believe he wasn't hurt worse than he was. It gave him a chance to get used to being someone else.
"Mr. Sullivan?" said a Dr. Banerjee, scrolling through the chart on a tablet computer. "We analyzed the full-body CAT scan, which we often do in the case of a fall this severe, and it appears that you have no broken bones."
"That's great, isn't it?" said Charlie, spraying a little spit. He was still getting used to how Mike's mouth worked compared to the crocodile guy. It was like driving a different car for the first time after not driving for a long time. But human-sized stuff was coming back to him quickly.
"It is. It's amazing, really, considering. You're very, very lucky."
"I think if I was very lucky, I'd have remembered to check the buckle on my safety harness."
"So this was an accident?"
"Absolutely," Charlie said. He'd already talked to a psychiatrist, a social worker, and two people from the Bridge Authority, as well as a couple of guys from the painting crew whom he'd pretended to know.
"We don't see any organ damage from impact, and beyond the bruising, which is fading, and your dislocated shoulder, which should be fine after a week or so in a sling, it's only your mental condition that concerns me. There's no physical evidence of damage to your brain, although you did sustain a concussion. But the memory loss concerns us."
"It's just certain things," said Charlie. "Like, I can name every street in the north end of the city in both directions, but I couldn't tell you the address of my apartment if you gave me two numbers and a letter to start." The doctor nodded, ticked something on the tablet, scrolled back.
"I've also looked at your medical history, and it seems pretty clear going back 10 years. Hernia operation, that's it."
"That's it," said Charlie.
"So you haven't had a major accident in the last year or two? Motorcycle?"
"No, not that I remember. I think I'd remember a motorcycle accident, or knowing how to ride a motorcycle. Do I know how to ride a motorcycle?"
"I don't know. I just wondered. We had to cut motocross pants off of you. The CAT scan showed evidence of a pretty major accident within the last 2 years. Both hips broken, 5 cracked vertebrae, cracked ribs, all healed nicely, but recently."
Charlie shook his head. They'd had him in a neck brace at first, but after the CAT scan, they'd taken it off. "I think I'd remember something like that." He caught movement, looked up to see Audrey peeking in the door.
"Is it okay?"
she said to the doctor.
"Well, hello, sir, or madam," said Charlie. "Please, come in."
"I'll leave you to," said the doctor, bowing out.
"That's not funny," said Audrey.
"What? You changed your hair."
"I've given up the swoop."
"Who does he think you are?"
"Your girlfriend."
"My girlfriend or Mike's girlfriend?"
"Obviously Mike's girlfriend."
"And yet you were living with me, floozy."
She leaned over, grabbed his hand, laughing, and started to kiss him, then stopped herself and stepped back.
"Weird,"
she said.
"It's okay," he said.
"It's me. I feel like me, kind of."
"Might take a little while," she said.
What it took was 2 more days. When she picked him up at the hospital, when he got in the passenger seat of her Honda, as he was reaching for his seatbelt, she threw her arms around him and kissed him, hard and long, lots of tongue, not coming up until both of them were breathing hard. Then she pushed him away and reached for her own seatbelt.
"There," she said.
"Wow,"
he said.
"We're gonna be fine," she said.
"Weird, though, huh?"
"Absolutely." She put the car in gear and drove them across town to the Buddhist Center. There was an empty apartment in his building. Well, Jane's building now. And Jane was having it cleaned and painted for him to move into. But they still had to figure out how they were going to tell Sophie before they went there. "It's a lot for a little kid to take," said Charlie when they got home. He sat at the oak table in the kitchen drinking coffee. "I don't want to traumatize her." Audrey fussed with the coffee maker at the counter.
"Charlie, she's seen the squirrel people.
She's death. The big death. She holds dominion over the underworld. You're not going to shock her."
"I know. That's got to be really hard. And we don't even know if she still is death."
"I think you should just go over there and have Auntie Jane explain.
Sophie will know it's you. You sound like you already. You move like you. You just, you know, just don't look like you.
Speaking of which, how's he doing?
Charlie's former body, the wizard crocodile guy, sat on the floor in front of the dishwasher, rocking from side to side with the rhythm of the motor. Audrey had brought him home from the boat in a sack and had been caring for him while Charlie was in the hospital.
He's good. He's doing really good. I mean, he's, well, you'll see.
Charlie, come meet a new friend.
Really? Charlie said.
The croc guy made a delighted, growly noise as he climbed to his feet and scampered across the kitchen, his head and torso sort of wiggling back and forth as he moved, his lower jaw flapping, leaving a drop of drool on every downstroke, his long dong skittering on the tile between his feet as he moved. He stopped in front of Charlie and made an excited and juicy growling sound.
Charlie, this is Big Charlie, Audrey said, presenting Big Charlie with a bow.
Big Charlie looked at her.
You named him Charlie?
What was I supposed to do? He was Charlie for a year. I've talked to him for countless hours as Charlie, so when I see him, I think Charlie.
You're not the only one going through a transition here.
Anyway, I've decided on another name for him.
Which is?
Wiggly Charlie.
The croc guy jumped up and down, clicked his talons as if clapping, excited, drooly breaths.
See? He likes it.
He is pretty wiggly.
As if on cue, Wiggly Charlie resumed jumping, his torso, head, and jaw wiggling as if connected by loose springs. Charlie felt bad for the little guy. Then he felt bad for Audrey.
Was I this goofy when I first, you know, when I first moved into that body?
No, you were much more coordinated. There was kind of more there, less drooly.
Really? I mean, look at him.
Charlie looked at Wiggly Charlie, then at Audrey.
All that time, you weren't creeped out by me?
She sat down in the chair across from him, moved his coffee cup, took his hand.
To be honest, I was always captivated by your enormous unit.
Really?
She nodded, eyes down, humble and sincere.
Are you fucking with me?
She nodded, eyes down, humble and sincere.
She laughed. Wiggly Charlie made his breathy, excited noise.
Come here, Charlie said, bending down. We need to fix you.
Charlie untied Wiggly Charlie's wizard robe, then wound his dong around his waist and cinched his robe shut under it. So now, instead of a creepy little patchwork creature dragging around a completely disproportionately sized sex organ, he just looked like he needed to spend a little more time at a creepy little patchwork creature gym to work off his role.
There you go, Charlie said, sitting up to admire his work.
Better?
Wiggly Charlie frisked and drooled, clicked his talons together in applause.
Are you hungry? Charlie asked. Do you want something to eat?
More jumping, frisking, and drooling. Audrey sat back in her chair with Charlie's coffee in hand and watched this very strange bonding.
Let's get you something to eat, Charlie said.
He got up and led Wiggly Charlie over to the big stainless steel refrigerator.
I'm making him some shoes, said Audrey. The toenails on the tile and carpet drive me nuts.
Why didn't you say something?
Because my annoyance at toenail noise seemed kind of trivial compared to the fact that I'd trapped you in that, she said. Then to Wiggly Charlie, no offense.
Charlie scanned the shelves.
Do you want a cheese stick?
He held up an individually wrapped mozzarella cheese stick. Wiggly Charlie jumped, reached up. Charlie gave him the cheese stick. He immediately clamped down on it,